This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, former state lawmaker Ken Sikkema tells us why he thinks criminal justice reform can get passed next year in Michigan after it failed to make it through the legislature's lame duck session. But first, President Obama recently signed legislation that boosts funding for research into cancer and other diseases. The 21st Century Cures Act carries symbolic weight in a couple of ways. It's likely President Obama's last public bill signing before he leaves office, and it also passed with overwhelming bipartisan support in a Congress where partisan divisions have often been strong. West Michigan Congressman Fred Upton was the lead sponsor of the 21st Century Cures Act. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it was a good week being with the president and the vice president and my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, both sides of the Capitol. We all worked so hard together for the last 3 years. Lots of shoals, lots of rocks in the way, even Thanksgiving weekend. We were calling each other wondering, what time were you going to have your turkey dinner with your family? Because we needed a little extra time to still work out some of the details, because it was then going over the edge, bad news. But we were able to piece it together, and what a victory. It really was something else.
So if you had to give someone the real thumbnail sketch, the elevator speech about what 21st Century Cures means for patients and their families going forward, what would you say?
It accelerates the approvals of drugs and devices that have gone overseas in particular. We've seen a cut in medical research. Remember sequestration, all the different budget things. So this has substantial increases, over $6 billion. And the bottom line is we will find cures for these diseases, whether they be Alzheimer's, cancer, lupus, all of MS, years before we otherwise would have without this bill, which is why at the end of the day, it had such strong support. 392 votes in the House, 94 votes in the Senate. You can't even pass the approval of the previous day's legislative journal, which is word for word what is spoken on the respective House chambers floors with votes of that margin.
So let me ask you, though, to respond to what some of the critics have raised about specifically the idea that the FDA will be able to use some different discretion in terms of how they approve some drugs and medical devices. Does this lower the bar in any way for safety?
Not at all. And one of the things, you know, hey, we didn't pretend to be the experts. This was a multi-year event involving Republicans and Democrats all across the country. We had roundtables, we had committee hearings, events, dozens and dozens of events where, and we asked every concern group from the FDA, the current FDA, the past FDA, the NIH, researchers, patient groups, I mean, you name them, we asked them to come to the table and tell us what we needed to do so that we could find faster cures, not slower cures. One of the issues, specifically to your question, was we went to the FDA and we went to the former FDA directors and we said, here's our legislative proposal. You tell us where we're all wet. What do we need to strengthen this to make sure that those safety standards are in place? And they did. They went literally page by page. They spent days in one of my subcommittee rooms. A former director of the FDA, Andy Van Eschenbach, came in with his whole staff. And they went page by page and said, here's what you missed, here's what you didn't. This is great. Did the same thing with the NIH. But the other thing that we did, we boosted, I mean, we found that for a lot of these FDA researchers, and remember, this is really advanced science. This is using biomarkers. It's using the new genome model, all those different things. We learned that once the FDA officials that were working on these applications, they got to where they were at, in terms of ability to overlook and look at all these chemical compounds and everything else, they'd get stolen. They would get stolen by the pharmaceutical industry, and others said, whoa, that's the individual that we want working in our lab, which is, you know, it's. So we had to give the FDA more resources, not only more people, but be able to pay them
more?
A higher salary so that they wouldn't get stolen. And we did. We increased the FDA budget by $500 million so that they'll have the resources to make sure that that standard is still in place.
What about drug costs themselves? Because even if these drugs become available, there still is the question of, can you afford them?
Well, here's some more good news. Because in all likelihood, it's going to take a shorter period to get them approved. Remember, the short term of our bill, 21st Century Cures, the short title is Faster Cures. Because it's not going to hopefully take as long, because they're going to see some exciting breakthroughs that they can get to the market faster, that difference in time could be as much as maybe even $200 million in terms of R&D that the industry will have to do to check all the boxes to get it done. So if you can get it done in 3 or 4 years in terms of the application instead of maybe 5 or 6 years or even longer, guess what? That cost is going to go down, which should be reflected in the cost that the patient then pays. And of course, we'll have some overseen. We had the issue with the EpiPens and others, so they know we're looking over their shoulders to look at this. But at the end of the day, I got to say that that cancer-saving drug, that resolve to find Alzheimer's, whatever it is, it's going to be less than it otherwise would have been, number one. And number two, it's going to reach that patient and their family maybe years faster than it otherwise would have without our legislation.
Another question that's been raised is the funding itself. Does this have to come back before Congress? Is it going to go through the budget approval process every year?
We made absolutely sure that the money's going to be there. So that was one of the things we did on Thanksgiving weekend was I called Speaker Ryan. There's some questions about it. And even though we had made the insurance, I'm just a committee chairman, not the speaker. And the speaker agreed to reach out Thanksgiving weekend to former Speaker Nancy Pelosi and then verified it in a letter that the money was going to be there in this, not only in this fiscal year, which, again, we had a stopgap continuing resolution, which ended December 8th. So that money is there in this fiscal year. But in the signing ceremony that we were at with both former Speaker Pelosi and Paul Ryan, Ryan confessed again that we're going to make sure that the money's there, and it will be. We wrote it in such a way that, and I'm a fiscal conservative, you and I go back a lot of decades, actually, but as a former Reagan official, I care a lot about the deficit, and what we did was we found real offsets, budget reductions in other places, and those savings will then be transferred to the appropriators, of which they can only use it for what we prescribed. So diseases of the brain, the FDA money, the cancer research, all of those things year by year come in from the savings that we will account for, dollar for dollar.
Where are you getting that money, though? Doesn't some of that money come from some other public health programs?
Well, it did. Some of it came from the preventive health program, which was part of Obamacare, and there was a lot of money in that pot. So we've got it. We captured it. It's not going to be going away. We got money from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Again, this dates back to the 70s. It's a different place today, energy. We are now actually exporting crude oil. Back in the 70s, we were importing a good majority of the oil that we took in. And back from the 1970s, the Congress set up the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, where literally millions of barrels of oil, hundreds of millions, are stored in underground reservoirs, primarily in Louisiana. We still are going to maintain internationally what we signed off on, what we would do in case there is an oil embargo. But we also know that because we're producing oil now, we're probably never going to have to tap that. So we still keep the reserve, but in fact, we're going to sell some of it, of which those sales will go to health research to find the answer for the cure. So $900 million of the money that we did was going to be for sales over the next couple of years.
Okay, we went from healthcare to energy in that answer, so I'll stick with energy for a moment and ask you about the closing of the Palisades nuclear power plant, which is in your district. You know, there has been some calls to re-examine this. The Van Buren County Board of Commissioners, State Representative Eric Nesbitt, has said that he would like perhaps it to be blocked by the Michigan Public Service Commission. But you, in your statement, you were pretty explicit that this should not be stopped. This should go forward, that there is a time for nuclear power plants to close.
Well, I support nuclear power, safe nuclear power, always have, been a leader in the issue, a little different than this, but the high-level nuclear waste. But at the end of the day, we know that all of our nuclear power plants, the ones that we have online, they have a limited life. They're not going to go on forever. They have to be operated in a safe manner, and they need to be beyond political interference, that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, experts for sure, have to safely regulate and determine whether those plants are operated safely or not. And as I have been to Palisades, as I've been to Cook and a number of other facilities around the country, the NRC is there 24/7. In the case of Palisades, they have a number of contracts, and yes, I think the Michigan Public Service Commission will have some say. I don't have, you know, I don't have role in that issue as well as it relates to their contracts. But I know that there were some contracts that Entergy, who currently owns Palisades, had with Consumers Energy, which used to own Palisades, in the market, I want to say in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And on their own, they determined that the added investment to make sure that Palisades is run beyond the current refueling issue that they have now was not going to be economically viable for them to stay open, knowing, of course, that there are still additional tests on the brutality and other things, again, that the NRC determines. And as I guess as an economic issue as it relates to producing power, serving the millions of people that they do, they made the decision that beyond 2018, it was not going to be economically viable for them to continue where they are. And, you know, they're working on a settlement. Obviously, you know, it's a huge economic impact in Southwest Michigan. They're the largest property taxpayer in Van Buren County. They have about 600 employees that work there, a pretty good salary. Many of them are nuclear engineers, you know.
And what would you like to do for them? Because now they are, you know, looking at it a couple years down the line that the plant will be closed and they'll be out of work. What do you think is the federal government's role there?
Well, I don't know that there's a federal government role per se, but my sense is, and I've had just a couple of conversations with Entergy. We'll obviously have some more, is that, you know, they have other nuclear installations. There is always a need for these folks as people retire. I don't know that the volume of nuclear engineers is the same as it was in the 70s or 80s. I would presume that there will be opportunities that will be made for them. Obviously, they're not going to be continue to live in Covert or other place, South Haven, the Twin Cities. But they'll make steps to make sure that there are opportunities for them. Again, it's a wanted field. And I know, too, that Entergy is going to be working with the state to provide perhaps as much as $10 million in additional funds for charities and other things where they've been certainly a major player in West Michigan. But ultimately, you know, we knew at some point the plant was going to close, whether it be 2018. This is earlier than anyone anticipated. It's unfortunate. There's no question. But those decisions are made at that type of level. They have to have the NRC blessing and obviously the Michigan Public Service Commission as well. And we'll see where it takes us.
This is the first time you've been in since the election, so congratulations on your reelection and the first time we've had the chance to talk about President-elect Donald Trump. You mentioned earlier that you have always prided yourself on being a deficit hawk. So I have to ask you, what are your thoughts about the president's proposals, which so far seem to include cutting taxes, spending more on infrastructure and defense, says that he wants to protect Social Security and Medicare. How does a deficit hawk get to a yes vote on all of that?
Well, we got to see what the details are. Now, he can't do this by executive order. It's got to happen through congressional action. And, you know, for me, when I got started, I was the only Michigan member of Congress, Republican or Democrat, on the Transportation Committee. And roads and infrastructure are mighty important. You can't have businesses here. You know, I look at I-94, I look at 131 and 96. I look at water infrastructure lines, and I had a hand in brokering the successful agreement with Flint. But you need a strong infrastructure. And our roads—
You need to find ways to pay for it.
You
got to
find ways to pay for it. There's a couple ideas that are out there. And of course, as we know, the gas tax has not been the answer. It stayed the same for the last 20-some years now. It's not has not kept up with inflation. It's the same gas tax that it was in the 90s as is today. Our cars are driving more miles per gallon, maybe even double what they were before. They're going to be 54, you know, under a proposal that President Obama signed off on a couple weeks ago, 54 miles a gallon by the year 2022.
So do we need a larger gas tax?
Well, I think we have to find other ways to figure out how to finance this, and that will be occurring, I think, as you look at an infrastructure bill that will move forward. But, you know, the good news on the deficit, 6-7 years ago, our deficit was $1.1 trillion a year. This last year, it's about half of that. So we've made real strides, not only in terms of reducing it, hopefully someday soon getting to a balanced budget, but also as a percentage of GDP, it has also gone down as well. So we have to keep on that track. But we have to look, you know, it'll be, you know, one of the big issues that we're going to deal with early in the next Congress with, you know, it's even though the Republicans control the House and Senate, the margins are pretty small. In the House, of course, we lost some seats. We'll be at 241. In the Senate, we lost a couple of seats. We're at 52. President Obama, when he was first elected, had 60 in the Senate. So
well,
filibuster proof. No, it was 60-40.
Well, remember, he had to wait, though, for Al Franken's race
but
to be settled.
He still had 60-40.
He had 60-40 for part of his first 2 years, correct.
And then when Kennedy died, then, of course, there was a special election, I think, is what changed that, or maybe an appointment. But in the House, you know, this last year, you know, Speaker Pelosi, she had an 86-vote margin when he was first elected. So they were able to do a lot of things. That the honeymoon, we'll see how long it goes for President Trump. We'll see what some of his proposals will be when he gives his first speech, really, to the nation on January 20th, and then does his State of the Union speech probably a couple weeks later.
West Michigan Congressman Fred Upton, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
In January, Fred Upton will begin his 16th term serving Southwest Michigan in the U.S. House. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The Michigan legislature has adjourned for the year. The lame duck session included action on an energy overhaul for the state, increasing speed limits on some rural highways, and limiting the use of seclusion and restraints in schools. But some legislation did not win final passage before adjournment, including bills to reform Michigan's criminal justice system. Ken Sikkema served 20 years in the Michigan legislature, including 4 years as Republican Senate Majority Leader from 2002 to 2006. He's now a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants in Lansing. Ken Sikkema, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be with you, Gordon. Thank you.
You have been a proponent of the criminal justice reforms, which were before the Michigan legislature. So how would you categorize your reaction to this? Are you surprised, disappointed, some of both?
Well, I'm disappointed that these major criminal justice reform initiatives didn't make it all the way through. They are major changes to how we look at criminal justice. They passed one house. Actually, there was a house package dealing with parole reform that passed the House, died in the Senate. Then there was a Senate package that dealt with probation and parole reform that passed the Senate and unfortunately died in the House. And So, yeah, I'm disappointed that they were left on the table. There are a lot of big issues that were left on the table. So the criminal justice package wasn't alone, but, you know, they were ready to be passed. They passed muster in one house or the other. But I think the legislature is going to take them up again in the new session.
There were some bills that passed concerning people who are exonerated of crimes and have spent time in prison. Also, some bills passed regarding indigent defense. Is maybe the political lift a little bit heavier when you're talking about people who have been correctly convicted of a crime, or at least we think so, and what to do with them going forward in terms of sentencing, et cetera?
Well, Gordon, you're right. There were some bills that, you know, kind of nibble at the edges of criminal justice reform that did pass. But, you know, some of these, I think that one of the big heavy lifts here is reform of our parole system. That's the bill that passed the House and died in the Senate. And it's a major initiative. It really does constitute kind of rethinking criminal justice in Michigan. Today, the system is, you know, you have someone who's convicted of a crime gets sentenced by a judge to a minimum and a maximum sentence, and you are eligible for parole when you've served your minimum sentence. That's when you become eligible. And it's up to the parole board to decide whether to parole you or not. What this bill does is it basically says, look, if someone has served their minimum sentence, so you still have what's called truth in sentencing, they don't get out before you serve your minimum, but if they've served their minimum and if they're evaluated properly by the correction system and are judged to be low risk, you presume they become paroled. And that's the big change that this bill would make. And it's done for a couple of reasons. One is it would save considerable amount of taxpayer dollars. Department of Corrections is estimating that it would probably, over a five-year span, eliminate the need for about 3,200 beds, save $75 million a year of taxpayer money. Secondly, and this is equally as important, is research that's been done around the country, not just in Michigan, but in other states in the last few years, indicates that just keeping low-risk prisoners in prison for longer periods of time doesn't result in more public safety, more community safety. And that's the change in thinking, if you will, over the years. You know, when I was in the legislature and I was a part of this, we particularly in the 80s when kind of drug crimes exploded, we thought just keeping people in prison for longer periods of time results in more public safety. Never really thought about the taxpayer issue. Well, now we're realizing that, no, it doesn't increase public safety. And from a taxpayer standpoint, you know, it just kind of throws money at a problem. So that's the kind of reform that this particular House bill would have made that didn't get through the Senate.
You were quoted in the Gongwer News Service back on December 9th as saying that this was a golden opportunity for the Michigan legislature. So since they've adjourned without passing the bills in this criminal justice reform package, is it an opportunity lost or simply an opportunity delayed?
Well, I think it's going to be an opportunity delayed. The reforms that have been kind of percolating in Lansing in the last session, they're going to come back, in part because the political makeup of the legislature hasn't changed come January. You're still going to have a Republican House, Republican Senate, Republican governor. These reforms, particularly the parole reform, came out of a conservative Republican House, and that political dynamic isn't going to change. So as much as I'm disappointed that these things didn't get all the way through, I'm pretty confident and pretty optimistic that you're going to see them again. The momentum is there. It's one of the few issues, criminal justice reform, it's one of the few issues that have united sort of liberals and conservatives in an era of great political polarization, not just in Michigan, but around the country. And that's why I'm convinced you're going to see them again.
When you look at this package of bills yourself, are you supportive of everything in them across the board? Or are there things in there that you say, well, I could live with that, but it wouldn't be exactly the way I would write it if I were currently in the Michigan legislature?
Well, you know, perfection, Gordon's in the eye of the beholder.
Sure. And rarely achieved in legislation, so.
Yeah. I mean, compromise is the order of the day. You know, anybody who doesn't want to compromise, you know, I would say, you know, the legislature is not a good spot for you because you do have to make compromises. And I'm not just talking about, you know, Democrats compromising with Republicans. Even when you're in a majority, Republicans are today, you got to compromise with other Republicans. You know, it's one of the reasons these bills didn't pass. The House couldn't compromise with the Senate, and the Senate couldn't compromise with the House. And that was a Republican issue, not a Democratic issue. But the big enchilada here, the big one in the room, is reform of our parole system and going to this concept of presumptive parole if you're a low-risk prisoner and you've served your minimum sentence. That's the key. That's the one that would save taxpayer money. That's the one that would have the biggest impact.
And are there some reasons, legitimate reasons, that someone on the other side may be hesitant about presumptive parole? I mean, can you understand how, as I understand it, it was the Senate that was a little more reluctant on presumptive parole than the House? And can you understand where the Senate's coming from?
Oh, absolutely. You know, this, you know, we're still, I think, living with kind of the attitude of, you know, let's just be tough on crime, and meaning that, not that we don't want to be tough on crime, but tough on crime for a couple of decades now, three decades, has meant just keep people in prison for a longer period of time to make sure that our communities are safe. We're still living with that sort of definition of what tough on crime means, because sure, nobody wants a paroled prisoner to commit another crime once they're paroled. I think that the difference today is, yes, let's be tough on crime, but let's also be smart on crime. And let's realize that just keeping in people in prison, and this is an important caveat, if you're judged to be a low-risk prisoner, just keeping them in prison past their minimum date doesn't improve public safety. Now, on the other hand, Gordon, and this is to your point, you can't guarantee, and you can't today guarantee, that someone who gets paroled or serves their maximum sentence and gets out of prison, you can't 100% guarantee that 100% of those people are never going to commit another crime. But that's true today. You know, 95% of the people in prison are eventually going to come out, and you can't guarantee that today. So why not use the new research that we have available that generally says low-risk prisoners are best paroled if they've been given the tools inside prison, you know, education, your GED, rehabilitation services, best get them back in the community and be a productive citizen than just languishing in prison. But there's no guarantee, Gordon, on this, and there isn't any guarantee under the current system either.
So you mentioned that you think there is still momentum. Is it your hope, then, that this would get picked up fairly early next year in the legislature, so that, in other words, the momentum does not get lost 6, 8, 12 months down the line?
Yeah, I think it's because 2018 is, again, an election year, and a big one in Michigan, because the governor's seat will be up. The Senate will be up, unlike this last year, and the House. Because of that, it's important to get movement on this package of bills early in 2017. Because 12 months from now, when the calendar changes from December of 2017 to January of 2018, you're in a pretty big election year. And then it gets tougher, because lots of issues get politicized. So for that reason, it's probably important to try to get these bills over the hump within 12 to 15 months.
Ken Sikkema, thank you very much for your time.
Gordon, thank you. Have a great day.
Ken Sikkema is a former Michigan lawmaker. He's now a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants in Lansing. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Mm-hmm.